Sir, this conference is now being recorded. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Ray. Would you like me to do a quick roll call now that we've started the recording?
Yes, please.
Good morning, good afternoon to everyone. On today's call, we have Avery Doria, Ron Andruff, Wolf Ulrich Knoben, Robin Gross, Ray Fassett, and from staff, we have Julie Headland, myself, Gisela Gruber-White. Apologies, we have Eric Bronner-Williams and Rob Hogarth. And if I can just remind everyone, please to state their names when speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you.
Okay, this is Ray Fassett. Thanks for everybody joining the call. And I was a few minutes late. There may have been some preliminary discussion on the fact that a new document has been circulated with a new format based on our last call. Julie, have you already gone into a bit of description of that?
I had not yet, Ray. I was waiting for you, but okay. I'm happy to describe the document. And I had asked if everybody has the most recent version. And I know that Wolf had sent around the version with his edits, and that is the most recent version with his initials WUK and edits at the end of the title. And the difference with the document is that the original is the existing operating procedures where we have deleted material. That material, that text is stricken, is shown as stricken with lines through it. New text is shown in red, and then edits by Ray and Wolf are indicated as various highlighted colors as tracked changes, and some will have comments associated with them if you have the comments turned on. I think that's it, but I'm happy to answer any questions on the format.
Okay, thank you, Julie. And as a quick summary, part of this from a blocking and tackling standpoint is, when we feel appropriate, this document needs to go to the OSC for its review and feedback. So it becomes, what documents are we sending? And what we talked about last week, and I think reached a rough consensus on how to do this, was we would, of course, send a clean version, if you will, to the OSC. In addition, we would send a version that could quickly show the reader what the old rules of procedures were and then the new rules of procedures. That's the document basically that we're looking at now, this format. And then a third version would be the document that has a lot of the history. In case somebody wants to really go back and look at, somebody at the OSC level or other, wants to go back and look at, well, how did that change happen? What was the discussion? That third document is more of a historical way to do that. But we anticipate it's this format that we're looking at now that shows the old and then the new is what we think is the most efficient way for someone to review this to understand what the new rules of procedures are that we're recommending. So with that said, a plan of attack here, unless others object, is to use this document that I have titled GNSO Council Operating Procedures Revised 090831-RAY-WK edits.doc as the document we'll use today.
This is Aubrey. Can I make one comment on on that document?
Yes.
I appreciate and thank whoever cut the thing I had put in on the method, the possible method for electing a chair in. One thing I noticed is it was put in as if it were generic for both chair and vice chair, and I had only thought it through for chair. So if I was looking at the numbering now, as opposed to CD, et cetera, it would really be A1, A2, A3. And so I think some of the confusions that came out were reading it as if it applied to both, whereas it really only applied to chair.
Aubrey, this is Julie, and I'm sorry. I pasted that in, and you're absolutely right. I shouldn't have done it that way. And thanks so much for clarifying that. I'll make sure we correct that, in whatever.
Okay, thanks. I just didn't understand where some confusions were coming from, and then I figured it out. and thank you for cutting it in. I wasn't specific about where to cut it in because I just sent it as a proposal, but I thank you.
No, thank you very much, Avria.
Okay, so this document has that Julie sent around this morning, and then I provided some edits, and then Wolf provided some edits. As a plan of attack for this call, do we want to just go through each of the sections? If anybody has any comments, going all the way up to background and organization, obviously if there aren't any comments, we'll fly through that section really quick. Do we want to start and attack this document today that way?
Agreed.
Yes, okay. Great.
Thank you, Ron. So let's just go ahead and jump in. So we have, you know, the first, number one is background and organization. I don't have any edits to what it says now. Okay. Moving on, number two. Anybody offer any edits to number two?
Ray, this is Julie. Perhaps I should explain for those who haven't been following this whole process that what I have done and what is different from the way the old operating procedures were written is the old operating procedures had language that appeared both in the procedures, as I understand it, both in the procedures as well as in the bylaws. But in order to avoid confusion, what we're doing in this document is where language appears in the bylaws, we're simply referencing the bylaws. And there'll be, I think, in an ultimate, you know, version, live links to that material and also perhaps an appendix that lists that material with links to that appendix. But the idea is to avoid confusion between where text appears. So if it appears in the bylaws, that's the only place it will be. At least that's our proposal. And if it appears in the operating procedures, then that's the only place it will be, and for places where the text appears in the bylaws, it's referenced accordingly.
Okay, yeah, that's a good clarification. So does everybody understand that instead of repeating language from the bylaws, we're simply citing the bylaws where appropriate in the rules of procedure?
Understood.
Okay. So that again, so when we look at number two, that's exactly what we're doing. We're citing where the original text outlines, you know, a 2.2, a 2.3, a 2.4, these areas are actually baked into the bylaws. So we're just saying there, CICAM bylaws, Article 10, Section 3, that speaks to this existing rules of procedure that we're working with. Okay, so I don't see any changes. I don't offer any changes to number two. If we move on to number three, the heading is GNSO Council. You'll see a new 3.1.1, which speaks to the policy development process, where, again, this is baked into the ICANN bylaws, very, very specific. So we cited it. Now, Julia, just a point of clarification back to you. When we cite the bylaws, are we citing the existing bylaws, or are we citing the proposed revisions to the bylaws?
We're citing the bylaws as they were the bylaw amendments, the bylaws as they were amended and approved by the board at their meeting last Thursday.
Okay, so it's safe to say that every time we say CICAM bylaws, It's the existing bylaws or the approved revisions?
It's
okay.
The existing bylaws with the approved amendments.
Okay.
And that's a very important point, Ray, and I'm glad that you mentioned that because there are a large number of amendments and those amendments have driven a lot of the changes in these procedures. So these are referencing the bylaws as amended and as approved by the board. They wouldn't actually make sense if they were, referencing the bylaws prior to the amendments in many cases.
Okay, so that's kind of a new benefit for us because up till now, up until the last board meeting, we really weren't able to make that statement. We were presupposing the amendments that were going to be approved and incorporating them that way. So, but today we can say that these are the existing bylaws with the approved amendments. Is that right?
Ray, that's my understanding, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. This is Aubrey. I might add, none of us have actually seen those yet.
Aubrey, this is Julie. You're quite correct.
Okay.
I mean, I guess you guys have seen them, but we're still waiting them to be vetted by the legal folk.
Aubrey, yeah, this is Julie. That's correct. And really, actually, what I am operating with here is what appeared in the public comment period. So I will, of course, amend this as necessary when that, you know, final version comes out.
Right. Okay. Very good point. I mean, and I think we can all appreciate how tricky this is. You know, we got a few moving targets out there. That's why this has been a rather tricky project. So thank you, Julie, for all your work on that. So we have moving on to, I don't have any changes of 3.1.1 to offer. On 3.1.2, I had a minor change where the heading said GNSO committees, and task forces and working groups. We have to be clear, I mean, we have to be careful because I think the term task forces has a specific meaning versus working groups. So I think we're looking here to catch all the potential types of groups, whether it's a task force, a working group, or a work team.
Ray, it's Wolf speaking. So I'm asking myself whether this is not a task for these for the other groups, from the PPSC, that team which deals with working group model and the, maybe they will come up with some definitions or...
Yeah, right. So for now, since we don't really have those definitions, we don't have one term that catches all, that catches a task force, catches a working group.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be clear, we're not limiting 3.1.2 to task forces. We're not limiting it to working groups. We're really trying to, the spirit of this is try to catch all formations of groups, and all we're trying to articulate to the OSC is...
Okay.
You know, and the term task force, I think, if I'm understanding it right, could end up going away with the bylaws amendments or revisions. I'm not sure about that, but I think it could. So
this
we don't want to limit it to... Yes, Aubrey?
The task forces may go away after there's amendment of the bylaws based on what the PDP group is coming out with.
Yeah.
In terms of the bylaws as amended the other day, task forces still exist in it. The changes, as far as I understand, that were made to the PDP was just to change the voting thresholds based on the bicameral House. And it'll be when the PDP group makes its recommendations and they get sent forward to changes that the bylaws would change on that. So there's no real change at the moment. Task forces will still exist at the time that this document goes through.
Okay. So does anybody have a problem with just expanding that so it's understood it means task forces, working groups, work teams, et cetera? I didn't put et cetera in there, but...
I have one small one is that nowhere in the bylaws is the form of a working group or working team defined.
Yeah.
So those will be defined as Wolf was saying in the PPSC groups, and then eventually something will have to get attached here. But at the moment, those are still very ad hoc. What's defined in the bylaws are committees of the whole, and task forces and work teams are something that committees of the whole create at the moment. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. Again, that's what makes this tricky. I think we can predict that in the future there will be some definitions wherever it comes from with working groups and work teams. So we're just trying to guess that at this point. So it doesn't look later that we limited what we're discussing here just to task forces, for example. And as we move down into the document, we'll see this come up again. So for now, why don't we just leave that as is, and because we're going to be circling back to this again, I think. And then we'll just kind of make a global decision on how to do it. Does that make sense?
It's fine.
So we don't get too bogged down here. Okay, section 3.1.3. Again, I don't have any edits to that. Anybody?
Nope.
Okay, 3.2. I don't offer any. Anybody?
No.
All right, 3.3, none for me. Anybody? Okay, 3.4. I don't have any change there. Okay, so 3.5 is, now this is a section that we did spend a lot of time on. It's a short, but sometimes that requires a lot of time. And I don't offer any changes to that.
Nope.
Okay, now, yes?
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
This is Aubrey again. It says majority of voting members. Would that need to be majority of voting members in each house?
Hold on.
Okay,
we'll talk
great.
About that. A quorum is a majority of voting members.
No,
because we decided that it was okay to, you know, discuss business, but when it came to an action of a vote or some formal action, then that's when you put in that threshold of...
Oh, I see. Okay, I understand.
Yeah, that's okay. So on 3.6, and looking at that again, I did offer a change here. It didn't make sense to me, the part that says, except as otherwise specified in GSO Council operating procedures and the ICANN bylaw. It just didn't make sense to me. So for me to have it make sense, you can see there I deleted. So it reads, except as otherwise specified in the ICANN bylaws.
Yeah.
I think that's clear, less words.
Yes.
The only question, Ray, this is Ron. The only question there is that... Have you read in the bylaws that we have addressed this? Because if it's not, might point to the council operating procedures, because we have a voting discussion later on in this section. So it'll be in section 4, and then we start talking about voting. So I just want to make sure, you know, I'm just wondering if it might look a little wordy, but the fact is if it's not redundant, then we should probably leave it in. It's only if we all agree that it's a redundant statement, we should take it out.
Yeah, that's kind of where I fell, was a redundant statement. And what got me looking at it really was one simple word, and, where it says the GSO Council operating procedures and the ICANN bylaws. If anything, that should change to or. So then I started to look at it from that perspective, and then thought the quickest way or the most efficient way to solve any ambiguity or confusion would just be to take out that sentence. I thought it was redundant. That's my point.
Ray, so it's Wolf speaking. So I think if you compare 3.5 and 3.6 right now, it seems to me that 3.5 now is derived from 3.6 means that at the time of a vote there must be a quorum and the majority of voting members of both houses. Because, you know, if voting in 3.6, you know, any other voting action requires a simple majority vote of each house. So that means the quorum must contain a majority of each house.
Yeah, at the time of a vote, the quorum, yeah, you would have to have the quorum that equals the ability to vote. Is that your point?
You know, that was a question, obvious question before, you know, whether a quorum is a majority of voting members of each house. So I think it is, if you read votes 3.6, because 3.6 points out, okay, any voting action requires a simple majority of vote. Majority vote of each house. So, you know what I mean? We could include it in the 3.5 as well. So that there is no question, because, you know, if you have a quorum only with the voting members, not with each house, then you can't vote, because for the voting you need majority of both houses.
Right. I think that was by design.
Ray, this is Julie. May I make a comment?
Yeah, please.
So if I understand what Wolf Ulrich is saying, that if we are saying in order to have a vote, we need a simple majority vote of each house, then I guess now it does raise a question to me why we wouldn't then also say under 3.5 quorum that a quorum is a majority of voting members of each house. Because if the idea is to have that you must have a quorum in order to have a vote, then wouldn't the quorum apply to the voting members of each house? And I guess I'm asking this question because I think you and I, Ray, had spoken at one time about a comment I think that Chuck had made about making sure that we are always referencing each house. And
sure.
I don't know if this is a place where we have to make sure that that's a reference that's there.
Yes, that was a good point. That was really coming from the OSC is for us to always keep in mind, you know, each house, each stakeholder group, the bicameral model as we move forward. So, yeah, so that was that. But I think what we thought about here back on 3.5 was, you know, we wanted to mitigate against the chance that people purposely do not join into the meetings. And therefore, those that do join the meetings can't even have a meeting, you know, which is different than voting.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so we didn't want to put the high threshold of just simply being able to have a conference meeting or a meeting by having such a high threshold of requiring a majority of each house to attend.
Yes, but, you know, sorry, it was speaking. So, you know, 3.5, for somebody who reads the first time 3.5, he's of the opinion, by reading the last sentence, at the time of a vote, there must be a quorum. This means...
Oh.
Okay, if it comes to voting, then this quorum, which is enough for initiating a meeting, is also enough for voting, and that's not the case. We have different quorums. The one is for initiating a meeting, is just to start a meeting. Well, it's just having a majority of members. And starting voting is a different quorum.
No, Wolf Ulrich, it's not. I don't. That's not how I think the logic behind that discussion was more along the lines of establishing a quorum to start a meeting. If someone left the meeting and there was no longer quorum, no vote could be taken. So the logic on that, the phraseology can use some wordsmithing, but the logic was that a quorum had to be present to start a meeting. Then if the quorum was not present for a vote during that meeting, no vote would be taken and would be moved over to the next meeting.
And then if it when it comes to voting, then we will see according to 3.6.
Yeah, and I think you know the words what jumps out at me at the statement is the each stakeholder group. I don't know if we define anywhere in here what a stakeholder group is, we've always talked to the houses and each side of the house and so forth. So maybe there can be some cleanup there that might clarify that.
That's a good point, Ron, because I think where it does define stakeholder groups and stuff like that is when we reference the bylaws.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and that's my point. So the language that we used to have in the operating procedures is no longer there. So we may want to put in a word of definition there what a stakeholder group is, or just move it to that you have to have enough people from both houses present to form that quorum.
Okay.
In this new document. Now, because we've basically stricken all of the definitions that we might have had in the past.
I think it was a little bit misleading me, because at the time of a vote, there must be a quorum only means okay. The quorum regarding the attendance of the meeting, but the voting is different for that. I understand that.
Well, would it be helpful if we deleted that sentence?
Well, or you said where whenever a vote is taken, there must be a quorum.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Which is, by the way, this is Avery. Which is, by the way, a higher standard than we currently have. Currently, you have to have a quorum to start, but if people fall off, you can still initiate a vote, and then some votes get the absentee treatment. But that's a stronger requirement than we currently have.
Okay, and based on your experience, what is your opinion of that? Fair or unfair question?
It's definitely a fair question. I don't really know. because I never had to worry about, do I still have a quorum to start the vote? I haven't paid close, you know, near statistical attention to, oh, so-and-so left, I can no longer start a vote because I can.
I hate to punt this off to the OSC, but I think that's where we're a working team. So I think we have to get close on this thing and to a place where we have some general comfort and then move it over to the other bodies. And then ultimately the new council is going to have to ratify all of this. So, you know, I think there'll be more dialogue on it. I don't know if we spending more time on it are actually going to resolve anything, but I think it's important here that we just clarify that language a little bit about stakeholder group and say, make a note that wherever a vote is taken, there's a quorum. Now, if the new council finds that's unwieldy, it just doesn't work, or there's some absentee balloting system they want to impose, that's fine. As a work team, we're just suggesting this might be a better way forward.
Okay, fair enough. Any other comments on these two sections, 3.5, 3.6?
Well, Ray, this is Julie. There are specific changes I should be noting in the document. I heard a couple of suggestions, but it wasn't clear to me what the final judgment was.
Oh, I felt there was consensus on changing the last sentence of 3.5 to wherever the time for a vote or whenever the time for a vote.
Whenever a vote is taken.
That kind of thing.
What I was wondering.
Yeah, that's it.
There must be a quorum.
Whenever a vote is taken, there must be a quorum.
Right.
Then the other thing, Chair, was the issue of stakeholder group. Do we want to define it, or do we want to change stakeholder group to, say, something else?
Well, I don't want to change it. And if we go down the path of defining it, now we're repeating the bylaws, and then every time the bylaws...
Well, it's a short repeat, because right now, unfortunately, there's nothing to say what a stakeholder group is in this operating procedures document that I'm aware of. If there is, I'm fine. I'll step back from this.
Well, it's a matter of... how you view that. It's defined by a link, right? It's defined by a link to the appropriate section of the ICANN bylaws.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. That'll do it. As long as that, and then we're going to put a little square brackets around there saying this should be linked to something.
Yeah. This is Julie. That's a great idea. Why don't I indicate that this will be a live link so that when you click on stakeholder group, then you'll get to the appropriate part of the bylaws.
And note that, Julie, because we're going to hand a document off.
Exactly,
and
I'll
people won't have the benefit of having heard this discussion.
Right. Thanks, Ron. This is Julie. I'll go ahead and make that note right there, right now.
Okay. And then did we get to resolution on 3.6 on my thought of deleting GNSO Council operating procedures and just leaving it as except as otherwise specified in the ICANN bylaws?
For myself, Ray, I would be more happy with your second suggestion, GNSO Council operating procedures or ICANN bylaws. That way we kind of covered the waterfront.
Okay, I'm comfortable with that. Anybody else? All right, Julie, could you do that one? Just change and to or.
So noted. This is Julie. I'll take care of it.
Okay. All right, so now we're basically into the Section 4, 4.1, Selection of the Council Chair, and this is kind of all new to me coming in. Thank you, Aubrey, for contributing this. Do we have any discussion on this part?
Of course.
Before I go on, I know Aubrey's already pointed out that, you know, it applies to Vice Chair as well as Chair, or some clarification of that. It has to be done yet. All right, Ron, go ahead.
Right.
My question was simply that this is language to replace what was 4.1. Is that a correct understanding? 4.1 has been deleted out below, and this language is replacing it. Just right above 4.3 meeting schedules.
Right, Ron, this is Julie. Yes, this is replacing language that was there.
Okay, so that was that's all we had then with regard to the selection of chair. And Avery's introduced this this other weighted voting language to keep us in line with the two houses. Correct?
Well, Ron, this is Julie. The part that Avery added was an expansion on, and this is the way, and Avery, please correct me if I'm wrong, the language Avery added pertains to 4.1A, the GNSO chair shall be elected by 60% vote of both houses, and then it begins with all ballots will include the none of the above.
So that's the block in blue text?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And then, but what was there previously, the A and was A and B, you know, each house shall, B was each house shall select a vice chair via a 60% vote within each house, and then it followed a chair and vice chair may not be elected, et cetera. That was language that this work team had agreed on, you know, to replace the language that was originally there.
And Avia, maybe you can help on this one. And the none of the above option, could you kind of help define that a little better? So
okay,
I understand what
yeah,
none of the above means.
Right. Let me give a little bit more background. First of all, one of the things that came out of the board was a specific request to the council that we define what happened if somebody didn't win on a first ballot. So therefore, this is actually meeting a requirement. They had no such requirement for vice chair. They didn't really care. But they really wanted to know a full and complete process for how one elects a chair. Now, one of the things that we've had, for example, in the last election that I won as chair, I was a single candidate, and there was vote for Aubrey or vote not Aubrey. So not Aubrey could have well won. And then, you know, we would have had to hold a new election because I would have lost against.
So that's a none of the above then?
So the none of the above option is certainly been a practice that whenever there's one candidate, at least, there's the option. You don't have to just vote for that candidate or abstain. You can vote for not that candidate.
Got it.
And so that's been there for a while. The in putting together this, and as I said, this was just a, you know, suggestion of mine for how to deal with our requirement of defining a process. So the issue was, if we have more than two, then we start here. Now, my suggestion for adding none of the above from the beginning is, if really everybody hates all of the candidates and none of the above gets a full 60% of each house, well, then we know that we're in trouble, and why should we go through successive, you know, ballots to find out at the end of three ballots that everybody hates everybody.
Right.
So that was a reason that if none of the above makes sense when candidates equal one, it actually makes sense. But as I say, this is a recommendation for me. It's got no weight, and it's something I believe in personally, that we should always be able to vote for none of the above. But it's purely, in practice, as I say, it's been there for N equal one.
And one last question. Thank you for that. One last question was the minimum election interval. Is there established a minimum election interval now?
No. But now it's a simple majority, basically. It's a simple majority of the weighted vote in the council now. So by and large, once you got down to that, it's true. We could have gotten to the point of Aubrey against none of the above. None of the above wins, and then what do? We don't have that, and we don't have the interval. So there doesn't need to be an interval. There is no bylaw requirement that there be an interval. There was a discussion as part of, I think it was in the restructuring drafting team that we had, of do we think it's reasonable to go into an immediate other election right away, and one of the reasons that there was a thought that said, well, we might not need to, is because we have a bylaws defined the two vice chairs act as co-chairs until such time as a chair is elected. So since there was a bylaw provision for what you did if you couldn't elect a chair, there was just a thought of, let's give it time, let's see how new leadership evolves. And then no one defined what that minimum time was, and the discussion went anywhere from, you know, 1 month to one quarter.
Thank you.
Ari, so it's Wolf speaking. I have a question. Since I commented, so I found it seemed to me very relatively complicated, though, to go through such a procedure. But I had to understand what's going on. So the question for me is, the none of the above option, so I understand right now, but I'm asking myself again, why is it necessary to have such an option? Because We have other options. So we have the option, okay, of voting, yes, or voting yes to a candidate, or let me say just abstaining from vote, or the third one is not even not participating in voting. So what is really the difference in that?
And as I say, there's two parts to this. One is when there's only one candidate, it has been the practice. So it's not necessary at all. Mm-hmm. In current practice, when there's only one candidate, it's just been the practice to put it there. The rest of this is purely my personal opinion. I believe that by saying, yes, you have other options, you can choose not to vote, or you can choose to abstain, is indeed true. I do believe there's certain power in being able to vote. I think they're all a terrible idea, and we have to rethink this. And so, as I say, in the case of N equals 1, it's practice. In the case of others, it's purely my personal recommendation that it's a strong statement saying, you know, all the people that got nominated, all the people that put themselves forward, none of them pleases us. Because the idea that you're going to get 60% of each house to vote none of the above is a very serious threshold that you would only meet in a really sort of bad case. The reason I thought it was a good idea, again, just personal preference, is if at the beginning of an election you've got three candidates. Now, obviously, none of them is going to get 60% unless one is so favored. But by and large, you're not going to have somebody that's going to win when there's an N equal 3 situation. So that means you're going to have to go through what you said was a complex set of ballots. But I think anything that has a possibility that nobody wins in the first one is going to have some complexity and is going to have a succession of ballots. But why go through that succession of ballots if, you know, 60% of each house says, we don't want any of them?
Okay.
So that's my reasoning. As I said, only the N equals 1 case is current tradition. And as I say, so in my last election, I ran against none of the above.
Did you win?
Yes, I did.
That's good.
This is Robin. Can I get in the queue on this?
Yeah, Robin, go ahead, please. You're up.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea to extend that practice to all the elections. And I think the reason why is because it sort of incentivizes stakeholders early on to try to find candidates that are acceptable to those outside of their own immediate constituency or stakeholder group. So I think by having that on there, it's as always a possibility, it provides a certain incentive to find candidates that really kind of reach across boundaries and can help build consensus in the long run.
Well, this is Ray. I'm not against it. I'm hearing more for than against. Any other comments on this?
So, well, speaking, so under D, so in case if you have more than two candidates, that means with three candidates, for example, so after the first ballot, then the two candidates which fail the majority of the highest, let me say, voting number, they will not have a chance for a second time. Is it?
I didn't understand the question.
Pardon me?
This is Aubrey. I didn't understand the question.
Well, the question was, you know, if in case you have three candidates, so I understand after the first balloting, you count the votes for each candidate, And the one with the highest votes shall then be voted again.
Yes, a standard runoff. Yeah, that would be a standard runoff. And even if you had seven candidates at the end of the first round, if no one managed to win you know, 60% of each. I mean, if somebody manages to win 60% of each house, it's over. I mean, of both houses, it's over. But if you have seven candidates or three candidates, if no one can, then you take the top two and you have a runoff. If at the runoff one of them gets 60% of each house, great, you've got a winner. There's still a possibility that one of them gets 60% of one house and 40% of the other, and the other one gets, you know, 70% and 30 or some such number. So at that point, you can tell that one of them is ahead, but one of them has still not crossed the threshold of 60% of each house. It's just the way, you know, the exercise could go. So you could have somebody that wins in one house, somebody that wins in the other. Now, if they're even, you know, you've got a problem. I'm not sure I covered that. But if they're not even and you can tell which one is ahead, then that one stands alone against a none of the above. And the house that didn't vote for them has to consider it.
Yes. But to understand, why do you have then a third balloting? So you're fighting a third balloting. So I understand it already is a second balloting. When you have the voting between the non above and the leader, isn't it?
Right. Well, the third ballot is in the case of nobody has gotten 60% of both houses, but one has gotten better than the other. So then it's that person still has not won. That person has still not met the bylaws threshold that says a chair is elected by 60% of each household, or the threshold we've got here. So it's saying that to be chair, you have to have 60% of both houses. It's possible that when you do that runoff, you still won't get there. You might have one that wins one house and one that wins the other. If one of them is definitely ahead, for example, you get, you know, 70%, 30% in one house, and you only get 46% in the other, and so on. So you can tell that one of them is ahead, but neither one of them has crossed the threshold. That's when you have the singleton election.
And that formalizes then the 60% in theory. I mean, either they're not going to make it by people voting none of the above, or they are going to make it, and then you've met the bylaw requirements.
Exactly.
All right, that makes logical sense to me. Is there any other comment on that?
I would add a statement to Ray.
Yeah, please, Ron, go ahead.
Pardon me. The definition of who's ahead would have to be specified that they were leading in both houses, because the examples that ever used 70-30 in one and the other 60-40, I couldn't tell which one would be ahead in that case, because one has achieved 60%, the other has achieved 60%. But one has achieved 40 in one house, and the other has achieved 30 in the other house. That, to me, would be the one ahead. But you could argue, no, the guy with 70%, he's ahead.
Yeah.
So we just have to, if we're going to go this way, we have to be very clear about the language, and I'm going to let Julie try to wrestle with this. To come back, I would suggest let her wrestle with it, to come back with some language on it. But basically what we're trying to say here is that there are a number of permutations that could happen. We're going to try to spell out what those are, but then we have to be very clear about what things like ahead mean.
Yeah.
So the other thing I would add is on D, it says in case that there are more than, actually there's you have to do a replacement, that we're actually writing the word T-H-E-N here throughout this document. It should be T-H-A-N.
Right, okay.
Yeah, that's me.
Friendly amendment. But in the case that, maybe rather than say in case that there are more than two candidates, maybe we should say in case there are three or more candidates and no candidate reaches. It just makes it a little clearer. It sounds almost redundant, the statement I just made, but there is more clarity in it. In case there are three or more candidates and no candidate reaches the 60%, then the runoff ballot will be held between the leading two.
Uh-huh. I think that's clear, Ron. I like it.
Okay. Yeah, I have to confess, this is Aubrey again. I originally wrote this as almost Algrimet, if n is greater than 2, then, you know, with an arrow. So I wrote that, and then I just translated it to words, but yes, yours is much clearer.
Yeah, I think those are good points, Ron. I think there does need to be, you know, we can't be so ambiguous on what does it mean to be the leader or what does it mean to be ahead. Julie, do you think you can tackle that one so we don't spend a lot of time now trying to figure that out?
Right, yeah, this is Julie. Just one initial suggestion in looking at this that I would make is, for instance, where it says a runoff ballot will be held between the two leading candidates, I would suggest a runoff ballot will be held between the two candidates leading in both houses.
Exactly. That's the kind of stuff I'm looking for, Julie.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Can I ask a question? This is Aubrey. Can I ask a question on that in principle? Is what if you have someone who is leading by a lot in one house and only behind by a little in another house? Now, theoretically, if you add those percentages together, that person is ahead, even though they're only ahead in one house. And so I'm wondering why the leader needs to be ahead in both houses.
Well, my knee-jerk response to that, Avery, is that in the case of the contracted parties, they've got someone they want to have put forward, and because they've got double-weighted voting and they've got this and that, all the rest of us over in the non-contracted parties' house kind of get left, you know, standing there saying, well, what happened? You know, again, you know, we've lost out on the vote kind of thing. There's a lot of uncomfortable, a lot of discomfort in the non-contracted parties' house right now. That, you know, there's a lot of changes, a lot of seats being moved around, votes being moved around, and so forth. So people are feeling a little powerless, and we don't want to exacerbate that circumstance.
Okay, this is obvious. I thought because it was dealing in percentages, there was no double weighting anymore. Yes,
no, there is.
It took fewer people to make the percentage, but percentages was the sort of paralyzing factor. But, okay, I'm not going to argue. I was just trying to understand.
Okay. Julie, are you feeling set here to try and tackle this one?
I guess I do have a question, Ray.
Yep.
Julie. So we are then trying to seek language to define what we mean by leading here, or do we want to just say leading in both houses? I mean, because to me, are we trying to say that leading means that you have, you know, we're going to set a number to that? I guess that's my question.
I don't think we can deal in absolutes here at all. I don't think there's any possibility of that because one never knows what's going to happen on any vote.
I think,
Julie, here my position on this is, if you go back and just give some thought to this and see how it makes sense to you, bring that forward, and then we'll wrestle with that one next week. But I'd try to wordsmith it right now. But I think the answer, the answer to this question is once you think about it quietly, without all of us talking in your ear, you're going to come up with something that feels right, and you'll put it forward, and then we'll debate it next week.
Okay, Ron. This is Julie. You've got a lot of confidence in me, and I appreciate it.
Well, I've worked with you for a while on this project now. You've always delivered.
I'll get together with Rob and some of the other staff and see if there's a way we can parse this out without being too absolute. My concern is that if we start defining leading, the word leading, in numerical terms, then it might make this very complicated.
Agreed. Absolutely.
Okay, so that's the point we're tussling with. And I think that's a good idea, Julie, is to talk to Rob and some other resources that you have at your disposal to raise the point. And maybe we don't have the resolution, but let's pick this one up again next week. And of course, by email, if you have suggestions.
I've just a small edit while speaking. So in paragraph E, first line, it should... it's written, a third ballot will be held. I think it's enough if you ballot will be held between the leader and the none of the above. Because I don't understand it's a third. For me, it's a second. But it's but anyway, if you leave it out, so just a ballot will be held between the leader and none of the above should be enough.
Well, this, Wolf, is actually a cascading set of statements here. So we're trying to spell out the cases. So first of all, ballots will have none of the above. That's in C. just to clarify that there is another choice on the ballot. D specifies if there's three candidates or more, and then E says that once we have those three candidates or more, how we ran those two off to try to find how we go forward. Then section E refers to if we haven't been able to resolve it even then this third ballot will be between the leader and none of the above. So basically, the second position is not a runoff again. Whoever was in the second position no longer is in the race under section E. Because we've tried now twice to ballot, haven't found a solution, but the leader, there is one clear leader in the group, that leader is going to run off against none of the above, and if everyone voting says we'd rather have none of the above than him, then we're back into a whole new re-election.
If that is the understanding of Harvey as well, so I was thinking in a time frame, you know, what the first ballot, the second, and the other one regarding the chair election. So in a meeting, but.
So I mean that's how I read it. But then the other thing that you just brought up in your comment is the issue of the minimum election interval, like that there's going to be a period there. Maybe we want to work on that language also to say that then a new election will reschedule within 14 days or some period. I think Avery, you had a sense, if I followed your verbal and written communication, that there has to be a period of kind of cooling off and people to rethink which way they want to go.
That's not only my view. I think that's a view that came out in general conversations in the restructuring drafting team, that you couldn't, if you didn't manage to, I mean, the whole bicameral thing is confusing and it's going to be hard to see how it really works. But if we couldn't come out with someone into, you know, it's almost like being in the College of Cardinals enclave. You're locked in a room for months until you come out with a winner. Perhaps that was it, but it was also felt that maybe some cooling off time was needed.
Well, I agree with it. I agree that there should be a period maybe where people take some time and step back from it. But I think better we define what that minimum election period might be.
Oh, yeah. No, I did mean for somewhere there to be a definition of minimum election interval.
Yeah.
I was just not defining it myself.
No, agreed. Understood. But I'm saying to the work team, we need to think about what that term might be. So maybe that's something we can give consideration to in this coming week. And when Julie comes back with the language, we might have hopefully ourselves given more thought to it and come back with something that we can suggest. Chair, how would you like to go forward?
Sorry, I had my mute button on. Yeah, it's a good time to point out that the OSC needs this thing by the 17th of September. I mean, that's the latest, you know, they need to take action on this in some respects. So, you know, today is the 2nd. You know, we really need to wrap it up, I think, next week. That's kind of what I'm identifying here. And then the sooner we can get it over to them, the better. So I think we're still okay. Yeah, we need some time to look at this. I think it's a good idea to define what the minimum election interval is. We could do it right now. We could come up with, we could say 14 days, come up with a placeholder number. What does the group feel?
14 days is less than one meeting interval. This is Aubrey. I think you want to give it at least one meeting interval.
Okay, so 30 days. Okay.
I think Avery pointed out, or someone's pointed out along the way here, that the vice chairs would serve in the interim position, so it's not like there's a void. So I think, you know, one meeting interval would make sense.
Okay. One meeting interval. You could even term it that way, I suppose. Okay. We comfortable with 30 days or one meeting
30,
interval?
30 days, I think, is a bit,
yeah.
This is more clear because people wouldn't understand what one meeting interval would be necessarily.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I apologize. I tend to be a software type and use variable names, but yeah.
Okay. So feeling a little more comfortable here, Julie, crafting this?
Yeah, and I'm putting that in now as in each place where our minimum election interval is mentioned, following that, I say, which shall be defined as 30 days.
Right. Okay. Anything more, A through F? Going once. Okay, paragraph right below it. You'll see I've offered this change, and I'm throwing this out there. I know we talked about this, but in looking at this, I think I feel a couple of fronts, or actually probably three fronts. One, the bylaws call for each house to elect the chair and the vice chair. I mean, that's pretty black and white. The original language is saying that if a chair is coming from one house, then the vice chair automatically comes from a nominating committee member, appointee. So right there, we're changing the bylaws. You could look at it that way. Now it's not coming from the chair and the vice chair are not coming from an election from each house. It's we're changing that by defaulting it to a nominating committee appointee. So there's that level. So I thought about that. The second thing is I think we might be confusing house with stakeholder group. So in trying to think this through, it seems what we're trying to really accomplish here is we don't want one stakeholder group having both a chair and vice chair position. You know, we don't want the registry constituency stakeholder group in the contracted party house to hold two out of those three positions, for example. We want to guard against that. But that's different than saying that the entire, different than saying that if a registrar constituency is the chair, then the registrar constituency cannot have a vice chair. That to me is, I'm questioning that logic. And of course, I can take this over to the non-contracted party house as well and come up with the same example. But I think what we're really trying to avoid here is that we don't have a stakeholder group that has both the chair and the vice chair. And if we just cover that bounds, we then are still remain consistent that the chair and the vice chair will be elected by each house. So that's why I made the change. Any comment?
We have just a chair and a vice chair. There's not two vice chairs. Is that correct? We're all clear on that one, as opposed to what's happening within the houses. So
right.
Okay.
Yeah, good point.
Okay.
Hi, this is Aubrey. I think that this is a reasonable change. I think the way the text was before, there was actually a question of, whether it was problematic in terms of, going against the bylaws, which said the houses will elect it. Well, you had a default coming in from somewhere else, which meant it hadn't been the houses electing it. So there had been a question on whether that was even consistent with the bylaws. And I know some people I talked to had been very resistant to the notion of an unelected NCA, especially since we don't know whether it's the newest NCA that will be in the non-voting position or the oldest NCA, the longest-serving NCA that will be in the non-voting position. You could have somebody who had just been appointed to the council all of a sudden defaulted to a vice chair, and so that had been mentioned by somebody as perhaps problematic. So I think it's a good change.
Ray, what I don't understand is the person shall retain his or her vote in that house. I'm not sure what that means. Could you shed some light on that?
I think the genesis on that one is just because you're the chair of the council or the vice chair doesn't mean you lose your vote inside your stakeholder group.
Yeah.
So just being, and I remember we talked about this, so we went, is that really necessary to say that? You think that's, obvious. But then I think where we landed at the time was, let's just state it to be clear.
How else could the chair be elected, the chair or vice chair? They have to come from one side of the house, don't they? I mean,
right.
As I understand it?
Yes.
Yes.
So therefore, if the chair and the vice chair are coming from one of the houses, Right. So the statement shouldn't say is if the chair or vice chair is elected from one of the houses. It is understood the vice chair or vice chair would be elected from one of the houses, but that person would not or shall retain his or her vote in that house.
Well, that's a good point because you're right because the word if is in that sentence simply because of the sentence before it. So if you delete the sentence before it, you don't have to say if anymore.
Yeah.
Good point.
So but it's fine. The chair or vice chair may not be elected from the same stakeholder group. Period. And then it should say that, notwithstanding being the chair or vice chair, that person shall retain his or her vote in their respective house.
Ray, this is Julie. Could I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
Further to what Ron just said, I might suggest that we simply say, the chair or vice chair shall retain his/her vote in his or her house.
Or respective house, in their respective house.
In their respective
house. Or the house they come from, whatever. So, yeah, that makes sense, Julie.
Yeah.
Tighter.
Yeah, that's good. Okay.
But that clarifies that for me.
Yeah, thank you. Any other comments on that? If not, there's a paragraph right below it. I think, Wolf, you have some comments on that?
Yes. It came up to be met by reading the question, because in case the vice chair election shall fail in one house, what happens then with regards to the to the chair in case no chair can be found? So that was my question here. You know what I mean? So if I look, for example, for the to the non-commercial party's house, so the 60% means we need 8 votes for one person to be selected as a vice chairman. And there could be a situation that says that nobody can be found because the commercial stakeholder group has 6 votes, non-commercial they have also 6, and there is one NCA. So in that case, we would have only one vice chair, maybe, from the other house. And the question is whether this vice chair could act as a chair in case it could not be selected. That's the question.
Okay, as a point of order, I don't know if it's just me or not, but Wolf, you are coming across not with clarity.
The garbled line,
yes. Yeah. So that might be causing why I'm not picking up the question exactly. Did anybody else pick up the question or the point?
Well, if I understand Wolf's comment, it has to do with the fact that the vice chair would also have to have 60% of the voting and that there may be some issues there. But I'm not sure if I'm clear on it either. As I read this paragraph, it looks to me to make a lot of sense.
Okay. All right. Let's think about that some more. Wolf,
yes, brother.
Are you okay, Wolf?
It's a perfect sense. I understand. But, you know, it could be the same case as with the chair election. In case you cannot find a chair with 60%, then both co-chairs should be put in. But if you don't have a co-chair, or only one, so what happens then?
Well, no, Wolf, the way this reads is that if the GNSO Council has not elected a new chair by the end of the previous chair's term, which means that the vice chairs must already be sitting. The chair and the vice chairs would all be sitting at that point, but if we have not selected a new chair, and if we go back into the statements above, you know, would be C, D, E, and F, all the balloting, then we would have a mechanism for that.
Don't we have the same procedure for the vice chair as for the chair? That the chair is only be selected for 1 year, and then re-elected, maybe.
Right.
And the vice chair?
Sorry, they're generally 1 year. But they're not necessarily elected at the same time. And as I said in my message, I don't know that we need the same process, torturous and complex process for electing a vice chair in one house that we need for the chair in both houses given the complexity of the two-house situation.
Okay.
In other words, to get a 60% in one house just means that each of the stakeholder groups holds to their own person and the non-com is the swing vote and you have 60%.
Okay. So I understand it's just the question for the first time, you know. Okay, so if you can find vice chairs according to the rules here for the first time, then we shall have no problem because the vice chairs shall remain as long as no new chair is elected, isn't it?
Yeah, and in fact, in these situations, except in this first instance, these elections usually happen a month or two before the old chair's term ends. I mean, so normally you're still going to have a sitting chair. Like this time, we only have a sitting chair for 3 days. Basically, I'll be the sitting chair for the duration of the meeting in, at least I think so, for the duration of the meeting in Seoul. At the end of the meeting in Seoul, I'm out of the council, therefore I'm out of being chair.
Okay.
Normally, though, the chair, in fact, my chair election was for 1 year or until new chairs elected, et cetera. So normally, whenever there's been a chair election, there's been at least a month or 3 weeks after the chair election is complete where the old chair is still functioning and you're starting to do a transition working together so that when the new chair takes over, it's a smooth transition. So normally it won't be the problem. This time, yes, we're going to be asking the two houses to elect their vice chairs on the Saturday so that they'll be ready. Now, if they can't elect them on the Saturday, they better well do it on constituency day on Tuesday. So this time there's certainly going to be pressure, and yes, as the sitting chair, I will do my best to lock them in a room until white smoke comes out for vice chair so that we have sitting vice chairs by the time Wednesday happens.
Okay.
But normally the elections will happen in different months even, and so it won't really be an issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good.
Okay. Are we comfortable to move on from this section?
Yes.
Okay, 4.3, I had just a...
I'm sorry, Ray. Just
please.
Square bracket thing, a retired chair
yeah,
will not be re-eligible?
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
Not be eligible?
Yeah. We were going to discuss today about how to reword that. Concern is we're limiting the chair to a one-year term. By the way, it is written now. So a retiring chair will not be eligible for re-election for a period of 1 year.
Board members and other appointees all have two-year terms, or are those staggered terms, 1, 2, 3, 4?
Board members all have three-year terms.
And
council
staggered.
Members all have two-year terms.
So why don't we allow the chair to have a, you know, if the council believes the chair is doing a fine job, re-elect that chair for a second time. So it may be that we want to just change that to say a retiring chair will not be eligible for re-election for a re-election for a period of 1 year following his or her initial two-year term. Something like that.
Right, this is Aubrey again. There have never I just wanted to make sure I understood. So the intent here is to put a term limit on the number of times someone can serve as a chair, and I'm fine with that. But because that hasn't existed before.
No,
I think we're term limiting everybody and trying to make sure that, you know, a lot of the thinking here, I'm sorry to jump in, Ray, a lot of the thinking is really to try to get more qualified people active in the ICANN process as it continues to grow and expand. And so that's why the term limitation issues are coming up at all kinds of fronts.
I think it's a great idea, then, but I think you should have a paragraph, then, that makes it explicit that, you know, a chair can serve a maximum of two consecutive terms. A retiring chair will not be eligible for re-election for a period of at least 1 year. And then you've got it. But this way it implies a term limit but doesn't really say it, so it takes an assumption.
I support that.
Yeah, I don't think the intention here is, if it is, it's new to me, to put a term limit on the chair.
Yeah, sorry, I'm not commenting on that one either way. I think it's fine to have one. I think it's fine not to. But if you're going to do it, you need to do it explicitly.
Right. Well, what we want to try and guard against is some chair during midterm is displaced, quits, whatever it is, and then that person cannot stand again for election for a period of 1 year. I'm wondering if we delete this. I'm still at, that's where I was last week, is 4.2. What's its purpose? Should we just delete it?
Yes. I'm in favor for deleting it, as well as speaking.
I'm in favor of that.
Was this added in, or was this part of the original document?
This was part of the original, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, this is Julie Ray, I believe it was.
Yeah.
So if it was part of the original document, then there was some thinking behind the idea of rotating the chair.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't interpret this sentence until Aubrey got on the call last week. I didn't even read this sentence to understand it to mean term limits until she brought that point forward. So I don't know if that's what the original intention was.
Well, I don't know about the intention, but I just think that it was the original thing. Comment was simply to say that the idea is rotating. I read it as rotate the chair around as opposed to blocking the chair from continuing. But I would support what Aubrey said about defining the chair's term and then defining when they can be reelected. I think it's important that we've brought term limits across the board for every other element of the organization, as I understand it.
So I don't think the board chair has a term limit.
The which one?
I don't think the board chair has a term limit. I know the CCNSO chair obviously doesn't have a term limit.
Right. The board chair does not have a limit. That's correct.
And CCNSO chair certainly doesn't have a limit.
Yes,
well. Well, if that's the case, then I that's consistent. We can be consistent and delete it. If there's no limits on the other chairs, then...
I refer to the bylaws, and the bylaws don't impose any limit. It just say, okay, shall be selected for a term not longer than 1 year. That means there must be a new election after 1 year, but that doesn't mean that the TOFA chair cannot be reelected.
Well, actually, when we think about it, isn't the fact that all of the GNSO counselors are term limited now, doesn't that speak to this issue?
Yeah.
In and of
itself. Yeah, but you could still serve 5 years.
It's still possible to serve 5 years?
Yeah, I'm serving close to 5 years. I had a partial term, and then I had two full terms. Now, I've only done 2.5 years as chair, but... theoretically, if I had been the type of person that was well-known and then gotten elected chair in my first year, could well have served 5 years. I think I would have been insane and in a basket by now, but still.
But going forward, am I incorrect in my understanding that all GNSO counselors will only serve 2 years?
Yeah, that's my understanding as well.
No? Two terms.
It's
two full terms, and it doesn't count a partial term. So
right, but that is a term limit of sorts,
yes.
And so that's what the term limit is, and so that sort of takes care of, building term limits into the council chair position just by simple fact that the council itself must rotate.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, again, I just think we can delete this.
And that being the case, I would support deleting it, too.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, this is Julie Ray. I've gone ahead and deleted it, if everybody agrees.
Great, thank you. If you guys don't mind, we keep moving on a little bit here. I probably have a hard stop in about 15 minutes.
Yeah, I'm about 5 to 10 minutes myself, yeah.
Okay.
Let's go ahead.
So meeting schedules, I think this is a pretty easy one. I just looked at it again, and the ICANN meetings are really not calendar year. They're fiscal year. As we know, October generally is the annual meeting. So I tried to tie the meeting schedules back into that. And rather than using words like finalize, because you really can't finalize, but instead to prepare a 12-month schedule of all meetings within 30 days following the ICANN annual meeting. Is that reasonable?
I would just say in consultation with the vice chair, I wouldn't just put all the onus on one individual. There should be some discussion about how those meetings are going to take place. And I'm just talking out of my hat because I haven't been attending, but I guess I would pose the question to Avery, is it conceivable that a chair could sit down and establish a 12-month schedule?
No.
That was a no.
I mean, no. I mean, it's hard enough to get people to agree to when the meetings are for the next 3 months. We've gotten good in that we're doing the schedule after each meeting. I think it'd be great if we could do it. We should try, but it's certainly not something I've ever succeeded at doing. I've been really happy that I got to meeting, you know, that I was able to go face-to-face meeting to face-to-face meeting and have a fixed schedule. It's worth trying, but...
Why don't we say this then? And the GNSO chair, in cooperation with the GNSO council, will prepare a 12-month schedule, 30 days following. At least it puts something on the table that the GNSO has as a work item, and if they can't get to it because of the things, they respond back to us saying it's impossible for us to do this, and at least it's been addressed.
Yeah.
Would that make sense?
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Does that make sense, Avery, from your perspective?
That
the council actually addresses it?
Yeah, certainly worth trying.
Okay, so how would that read now, the GNSO council?
GNSO chair
and
council will prepare a 12-month schedule of meetings within 30 days following the annual meeting. And then it says council members may request changes, blah, blah, blah. All the rest of it would be fine. But at least that would say that it's on the table, the council has to address it, and if they come back and say, you know, it's impossible for us to do this because of all these reasons, then that's fine. But from the operating procedure, we're saying that the council has to establish a schedule of meetings.
Okay. I'm okay with that.
And it's good that you put it on both of them, so it's not just the chair has to do
exactly,
it, and if they
exactly.
don't agree, the chair fail.
That's the point, yeah. Put the monkey on the council back.
Yes, Ray, Julie.
Julie, I just have a quick question. Since there's a possibility that it may not be possible for the chair and the GNSO council to prepare a 12-month schedule of all meetings within 30 days following the ICANN annual meeting, do we want to change the word will to may? The GNSO Council chair and GNSO Council may prepare? I just don't know if we want to even out here.
No, here's the point. Here's the point, Julie, is I think the issue here is to say we're calling on our council to sit down together and establish the set of meetings because in the past the onus has been on one individual trying to herd the cats. Now what we're saying is you're all sitting around the table, all together, we're going to get our calendars out, we're going to mark that stuff in because the second sentence addresses any changes or whatever might happen. But basically, we're putting their feet to the fire and saying this is an order of business. You need to establish when these meetings are so the community can have a sense of when you're going to meet.
Can I actually make a comment, Zavri, again? One thing you could do if you wanted to soften it somewhat, and then I recommend a second sentence, you could change the will to should. And what you can also do that at least keeps the current practice is each quarter after whatever the proper words is for ICANN meeting, the council will confirm that quarter schedule or something like that. So basically you're telling them that they should do it, but that each quarter they will confirm it. I don't know.
Yeah, but I think that's redundant in the sense that the second sentence says that it's council members may request changes during the year and agreed and so forth. So that covers any changes. But I think we should ask the GNSO and the chair to establish a schedule. We have right now. We've asked people. I think the board is saying that the meetings, in order for people to plan appropriately, we have to know a year in advance when the meetings are going to happen.
They're
going to happen. So in the same way here, we're asking the council to give the community a sense of when the meetings are going to be, and we all understand that things may change.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with the way Ron just articulated that. So, anything else on this one? Good points, Ron.
Do we have to say something about the frequency of meetings? I don't know if it's a practice, but it used to be monthly, I understand. Is it a necessity to have it monthly, at least monthly?
We talked about this last time. It had been monthly, and then because of the press of work, especially because of having to do both restructuring and council work and such, I backed it down to 3 weeks, but I think it should go back to monthly once restructuring is done.
Should it be written here?
So you're suggesting, Rolf, a schedule, so they should prepare a schedule of monthly meetings for the coming year?
Of at least monthly meetings.
Yeah.
Well, a 12-month schedule, if there's a gap in the months, you know, you go from January to March without a meeting, meaning February has been missed, I mean, that's going to stick out. Somebody can raise the question, why don't you have one scheduled in February? I don't know if we want to necessarily say that the GNSO has to meet at least once a month.
No, I think, actually, Ray, you're what you've written here, you're saying, you know, prepare a 12-month schedule. The GNSO will, and chair will determine, you know, what those meetings are going to be. And this happens after the annual meeting. So that means that we, as a community, will know that in the coming 12 months, like, say, 1 month after the annual meeting, we'll now know what the schedule is going to be, the general schedule, accepting that it will be subject to change. That way, meetings are going to take place over the 12-month period. We don't have to determine in the rules of procedure when those meetings take place or how often or whatever.
That's kind of what I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm getting to a hard stop here. Now, let me ask a question. Is there any chance, and I'm just asking, you guys, obviously everybody's volunteering their time here, is there any chance to pick up this discussion on Friday? Does anybody have the opportunity to do that? Avery, Ron?
Unfortunately for myself, I'm leaving tomorrow for 4 or 5 days.
Okay.
You mean this Friday?
Yeah. I'm kind of going on the fly here to see if we can carve out another hour to keep going this week.
I'm flying out of Sweden Friday evening, so I don't know when I would do it your time, because my day, I have time during the day that's free, but it would be in the middle of the night for you all.
Mm-hmm.
Some of you, anyway.
Is tomorrow better?
Tomorrow we have a council meeting, but that's at 11 o'clock at night, my time. Okay, let me look. I could possibly get it in tomorrow sometime.
Ron?
Unfortunately, I'm crack of dawn. We're on the road. We're It's a motorcycle trip, so it's not like I have access to.
All right, be sure to wear a helmet.
I will.
Okay. Julie?
Yeah, this is Julie. I can do a call tomorrow. The question would be whether or not we can get really enough people to sort of have a...
Robin?
Use Wolf? The word quorum.
Yeah.
But... what about exchanging discussions on the list and setting a hard stop for people giving comments on this current document by, like, say, Friday or something?
Okay. That's a good suggestion. All right. Let's do that. Okay, Julie. That's a good suggestion. Let's do that. Let's see if we can get some comment. Anybody? You know, we're going to go do a hard stop here in a minute or two. And moving forward, any comments from 5.2 on, I believe, 5.2 on? There are some edits in there. Any comments? We can do that by list. Up between now and our next call. Now, with our next call, we really have to be really comfortable as a work team, right, that we're ready to move this document upwards and onwards.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the next call, we should just prepare to stay on the call until it's done.
I agree.
I think we're not far from it. And,
I agree.
And I'm prepared to, next Wednesday I will be available, so no problem for me.
I think that's the plan. Does anybody disagree with that?
I agree with it. I recommend that next time we start at where we stopped.
Okay. Yeah.
As opposed to going back to the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Again.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that one. Now, the only thing I want to mention, though, is this, there's a new part that popped in from our last call. It's involving that template example thing. Where did that come from, Julie?
Yeah, Ray, this is Julie.
16.3.
Yeah, we had the discussion at the last call that it would be helpful to have the procedures for how the absentee ballot is conducted, because that procedure exists, but it hadn't been included in the operating procedures document. And so I asked Glenn to send me the language of how that procedure is conducted, and I've put it in there. It's really more just this is how it's done, as opposed to sort of a question of, gosh, you know, is there a better way to do it? It's just there so that someone can reference it and say, okay, I see how this is done, just in case Glenn isn't around and she knows all of this, but, you know, not everybody does.
Right. Okay. Now, with that in mind, there is some discussion in that about with what Glenn sent over with regards to proxy voting. Now, keep in mind, that's Section 5.8. We identified last week on the call that there is no way that we're going to be able to get the proxy section of this Rules of Procedures completed by October, by Seoul. There's just not a chance of that. We can continue to work on proxy, but it's not something we're going to be able to complete in order to seat the council. For one thing, anything we do on proxies has to go through staff council legal review. So what I'm saying is that we can identify that today, though. We can go ahead and at least communicate that proxies will not be completed. And we don't think it's urgent either, and this is also coming from the OSC. It's not urgent that this part be completed in order to seat the council. So when we get into the absentee voting, next week, as we will, very detailed, let's keep in mind that point, that we don't want to go off into proxies.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough?
Sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, with that, okay, next Wednesday we're going to do what Ron said. We're going to be on the call till we're done.
Okay.
Okay? And in the meantime, feel free to use the email list and any comments, any of the edits in here, please feel free. And Parabri's suggestion, we're going to pick up with, 5.2, I believe, and keep moving forward.
Okay.
Ray, this is Julie. Might I suggest that we ask Gisela to block the time of the call for 2 hours? Would that be good?
Yeah.
Because we do need to schedule that so that people understand how long this call will be and so that the operators know how long we'll be using the number.
Okay, 2 hours. And I think we're at an hour and a half now, and we're looking at that kind of time next week, maybe a little more than 2 hours. So,
uh-huh.
But, yeah, good suggestion, Julie. With that, I'm going to call adjournment to our meeting. And end the recording.
Okay. Nice chatting to you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.